This is Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off today. Today's Bradcast was originally recorded on August 13th, 2025.
Democrats act like they're not going to come back as long as this is an issue. That means they're not going to come back until like 2027 or 2028, because I'm going to call special session after special session after special session.
We're moving forward very aggressively to neutralize, neuter, to eliminate the 5 seats. We'll do the same here in California.
If California thinks they're going to eliminate 5 Republican members of the United States Congress there, Texas is not going to do 5. We'll add 10 more Republican seats.
Well, this is all going very well, don't you think?
Well, I don't. Scared in case I fall off my chair, and I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right, here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets and the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, Delmarva FM, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. Hey, Desi Doyen.
Yes.
You went to school in Austin, Texas.
Yes,
is that
I did.
Right?
Yep.
Hook 'em horns and all of that.
Yes.
The state capital, kind of a like a hotbed of liberalism in a sea of red out there in Texas.
Yes, indeed.
Along with the other blue oases like Houston and Dallas, correct?
San Antonio,
sure. Well, hey, bad news for you. That may be coming to an end soon, at least for voters in those otherwise blue oases who are about to lose their voice in D.C. altogether if Greg Abbott, the governor there, and Donald Trump have their way as Texas Republicans try to muscle a rare mid-decade redistricting bill through the state legislature to help Republicans gain seats in Congress. At Donald Trump's demand, residents in Austin, the state capital, could find themselves sharing a district with rural Texans more than 300 miles away, according to ABC News. While Democratic lawmakers in the State House of Representatives, who have slammed the draft map for this as being rigged and, quote, a power grab and, quote, racist, while they continue for now to break quorum by fleeing to other states to prevent a vote on that map in a special session called by Governor Greg Abbott, Republicans are attempting, in fact, to double down on their plans for gerrymandering. Their currently proposed map, for instance, chops up Central Texas's 37th congressional district, currently represented by Democrat Lloyd Doggett, allowing it to be consumed entirely. That Austin district consumed entirely by 4 neighboring districts, 3 of which Republicans now hold. One of those portions of the otherwise very liberal Austin area district was drawn to be part of the 11th district that is represented by Republican Congressman August Pfluger. It stretches way across the state into rural Ector County, about 20 miles from the New Mexico border.
Yeah, because, you know, Austin City residents share so many issues with folks in deep West Texas.
Yes.
In the rural areas where there are mostly cows.
Well, there are a few people who live there, but they live farther apart. They tend to be larger districts in physical size because districts are supposed to have roughly the same number of residents. No matter where they are in the country. So one American's vote is not more diluted than another's. Further, fellow rural voters are likelier to share demographic similarities together with each other rather than with urban voters. But with the new Texas map being muscled through, if possible, by state Republicans, urban voters are going to be cracked into small pieces and then asked or told to share representation with a huge rural population in the majority in those districts. It is, in a word, ridiculous. Under the currently proposed map, it would mean, for example, that people in that area, in that district that I mentioned, urban or rural, would share a congressman with people who live more than 311 miles away from them. A distance that is about 15 times more than that between them and those who currently live the farthest away. It is ridiculous. It's also, in another word, politics of the worst partisan kind. And what Texas is doing is lighting off a race to the bottom where Democratic leaders in states like California that currently have competitive districts thanks to independent redistricting commissions, well, they're looking to override those commissions now to push back against Texas and possibly Ohio and possibly other so-called red states who are now looking at doing the exact same thing in advance of next year's elections. There is, however, a way out of this mess, at least temporarily, at least maybe, according to my guest joining me momentarily, one that both parties, he says, should be able to get behind, and possibly even in advance of 2026. Color me skeptical, but open. And not only because the idea comes from, in this case, a Republican who will be joining me shortly, to begin the conversation on how to get finally, if not before 2026, finally find our way out of this mess. But if it's going to happen, it seems like it's going to have to include both folks on the right and the left trying to figure out their way out of this mess. Looking forward to that conversation in a moment. Another item or two, however, before we get there today, as tough guy Donald Trump is now deploying federal military troops on the streets of Washington, D.C., supposedly to help fight crime in the nation's capital, despite violent crime being at a 30-year low in the nation's capital and having fallen some 26% since last year this time, and despite the fact that Trump claimed on January 6, 2021, that he did not have the authority to deploy U.S. National Guard members to defend the U.S. Capitol against thousands of insurrectionists incited by, oh yeah, checks, notes, Donald Trump. Those National Guard troops have been taken away from their jobs now and their families. Well, they may wish to look to Los Angeles, where Trump did something very similar here in early June when he deployed almost 8,000 troops, National Guard and U.S. Marines, to, quote, combat, quote, violent insurrectionist mobs in and around Los Angeles. Of course, as we all said at the time, there was no need for troops to respond to small, if occasionally intense, protests against Trump's ICE roundups of migrants here in the city. Those protests were easily handled at the time by local police, but Trump wanted to be the tough guy. So the result was forcing a whole bunch of troops to leave their homes and their lives and their families and their jobs for 2 months for no reason at all. As the LA Times reported last month, the only thing many U.S. Marines and California National Guard troops seemed to be fighting was tedium. Quote, there's not much to do, said one Marine as he stood guard outside the towering Wilshire Federal Building in Westwood, which is at least 30 minutes or so from downtown, at least when there is no traffic, and there is always traffic. But downtown is where the protests were originally happening on a couple of city blocks. The protests that first met federal immigration raids in downtown L.A. were nowhere near the Wilshire Boulevard building. One Marine who declined to give his name because he was not authorized to speak to reporters said that his duties consisted mostly of approving access for federal workers at the building and visitors to the VA office. That was weeks after Trump had mobilized an extraordinary show of military force against the will of California Governor Gavin Newsom and LA Mayor Karen Bass. Few National Guard troops and Marines were in public view. Most were retreating to local military bases in Orange County. The GI Rights Hotline had received a flurry of calls voicing concerns about immigration enforcement. The GI Rights Hotline supports troops when they have a question. It's a nonprofit group that provides free, confidential information to service members. One of the folks who work at that hotline said that some military personnel told them that they did not want to support ICE or play any role in deporting people because they considered immigrants part of the community or they had immigrants in their family. Others said they did not want to point guns at citizens. A few worried that the country was on the verge of turning into something like martial law and said that they didn't want to be on the side of being armed occupiers in their own country. Many were shocked that the deployment orders were for 60 days. Well, that should give an idea to what the folks now being deployed in D.C. may be facing in the days ahead. And the question about whether any of it was illegal, at least out here in California, well, that is only being sorted out now in a 3-day bench trial that is wrapping up on Wednesday. Back in June, Major General Scott Sherman had a problem, reports TPM's Josh Kavinsky, on the third day of that bench trial here in L.A. He was in command of federalized California National Troops stationed in L.A. He had received a bizarre request. Immigration authorities wanted military vehicles and National Guard troops to support an operation targeting the city's MacArthur Park on Father's Day, when it was likely to be filled with families and children out celebrating. Sherman balked. Greg Bovino, a Customs and Border Patrol sector chief known for his flamboyant antics, according to the LA Times, purportedly replied by questioning Sherman's, quote, loyalty to the United States. These are just some of the details that emerged this week in that bench trial over Trump's decision to federalize California National Guard. The case examines whether the administration broke the Posse Comitatus Act by taking over the Guard and deploying it to L.A. During testimony on Monday, California called Sherman as a witness. He told an attorney for the state of California that, quote, intelligence did not indicate any threat to federal functions near MacArthur Park, but that immigration authorities wanted more than 50 military vehicles to drive through the park as part of the operation. It would eventually take place on July 7 instead, a Monday during the week when few people were in the park at all other than some school children for summer camp. But this is what is being examined at this bench trial as they're trying to figure out if any of this was legal at all or if it was all unlawful and or for show, for the cameras. You may remember that MacArthur Park event, which we reported on at the time, as being really weird. But that's what it was for the cameras. It's another example of the creeping presence of troops in American cities, said one of the D.C. National Guard folks who were speaking to cameras this week as they're being deployed. The creeping authoritarianism, which frankly is not all that creeping at all anymore. It is, in fact, between what happened in L.A. and what's happening in D.C. It's a way to normalize the idea of big government troops marching into major cities with guns pointed against American citizens. The very big government tyranny that Republicans use to pretend to oppose. At least when they believed that it would be big government tyrants who they did not vote for leading the charge. The liberal redneck comedian, as he calls himself, Trey Crowder of Tennessee, points some of this out today.
Right now, all the people who spent decades crying about big government and tyranny are popping bottles because Trump is taking over the DCPD and deploying the National Guard against the citizens of our capital. Classic them. Now, to be fair, this sort of thing is never what they meant by tyranny. No. See, our government forgiving the student loans of a working single mother of three, that is the true face of tyranny. But turning the Capitol PD into your Praetorian Guard and using them to intimidate the citizens into submitting to your will, there ain't nothing tyrannical about that. That's just good old-fashioned kick-ass lib-boning. That's all that is. Their basic stance on government action seems to be, if it helps people, tyranny most foul. If it hurts people, put that shit on pay-per-view. They love it. But so far, they at least still feel the need to try to rationalize this stuff in public. And the stated reason for this move is, you guessed it, crime stuff. Yes, in a very dramatic press conference, Trump said the city was overrun with violent thugs, merciless gangs, drug-addled maniacs, and worst of all, the homeless. Dun, dun, dun. Some rich lady faints in the back. It's ridiculous. And right now you're thinking, well, that sounds bad. How did I miss that? Here I thought D.C.'s violent crime rate was at a 30-year low. In fact, the last time I can recall seeing violence run amok in Washington was January 6, 2021, when a horde of sentient truck nuts overran the Capitol. Trump didn't deploy the guard then. Heck, he even gave those people pardons. So for him to do this now, something very bad must have happened. And you're right, something terrible did happen. Something so heinous that January 6 pales in comparison. That's right, the unforgivable crime that precipitated this drastic action was big balls getting beat up by high schoolers. I know. Big balls? Not one of the Trump administration's foremost policymakers, big balls. The very same. And I know we would all agree that verily Mr. Balls is a man of unimpeachable character and integrity, but his story didn't really add up. So it made a lot of people wonder, is this some kind of false flag deal, you know, wherein Team Trump is using an isolated, overblown incident as an excuse to expand their authoritarian vision, right? And I don't want to get too professorial or nothing, but my take on that is, you mean to tell me these assholes would use a bunch of made up boogeyman bullshit to do some up stuff? Surely not. Right? But a lot of other people say this is all just a distraction from the Epstein files. And to those people, I say yes and no. We should not forget about the Epstein files, but that sort of feels like, oh, don't worry about this. That is what's important. And it's like, I mean, this is also important. And it's like, that guy's only setting your house on fire to distract you from the fact that he abducted your mamma. And it's like, I'm not over the mamma thing, but a house fire is also a problem. Okay, the Epstein files are still important, but this is more than just a distraction, though. This is them soft launching martial law, you know? Like, you know when, like, Taco Bell devises a new delicious affront to God, and they try it out first in some random, particularly fat Midwestern city before they roll it out nationwide? Well, this is Trump doing that, but with Dollar Store 1984. So yeah, it's pretty important. Love y'all.
Yeah, it is pretty important. Don't let them tell you, oh, it's just the distraction. They want you to look there instead of there.
It's all bad.
We got to look at all of it. Don't let any of this become normal, because it is not. They're trying to normalize, as he said, soft launching, martial law. None of this is normal. We shouldn't let it become normal, because none of it is. So how does all this madness end, from the attempt to rig elections with a race to the gerrymandering bottom and federal troops now on the streets of American cities? I do not know. But I do know that now seems like a good time to start discussing where all of this could possibly be going and how all of this could ever end, if it ever does. Fred Bauer joins us next to do exactly that. At least when it comes to the redistricting nightmares now underway and seemingly getting worse by the day. That is Straight Ahead on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast.
There's got to be a morning after.
Yeah.
If we can hold on through the night.
We'll see about that.
We have a chance to find the sunshine.
Oh, wish us luck.
Let's keep on looking for the
looking. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Looking for that light. We have been reporting in recent weeks on this program on the brutal, ugly, and getting uglier by the day redistricting battle now underway in the great state of Texas, where Republican Governor Greg Abbott, at the order of Donald Trump, is calling for redrawing the state's U.S. House map in advance of next year's critical midterm elections, when Democrats hope to win back a majority in the House from Republicans who hold the barest of majorities right now. The party that stands in opposition to the White House tends to do very well in midterm elections, and if you believe the early polling, next year will be no different, with Democrats currently projected to make gains in the House against a currently very unpopular Republican president at this point in his term, when presidents are usually running at their highest level of support. In response to that and Trump's orders for Texas to take action, Governor Abbott called a special session of the state legislature to rewrite the state's already gerrymandered map, where the GOP already holds a more than 2-to-1 advantage in their congressional delegation, to add 5 more Republican seats, essentially stealing 5 currently Democratic seats, mostly in minority areas in and around the state's largest cities. But Democrats in the state House of Representatives in Texas are fighting back by fleeing the state to prevent a quorum from being able to vote on the new maps in the state legislature. Breaking quorum is a procedure allowed by the Texas state constitution. Also in response, Democratic governors from around the country have threatened to reapportion their state's U.S. House maps to counter what Texas is now trying to do. Most notably, for the moment, in California, where voters have written an independent citizens redistricting commission into the Golden State Constitution, Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom has vowed to push back against Texas if they are successful in rigging their map through a special session. Newsom has said that he would place a voter referendum on the ballot this November to temporarily waive the independent commission's map here in the state to allow Democrats to rewrite the House map through 2030 by gerrymandering it to take back the 5 U.S. House seats that Texas is attempting to steal from voters. I told you it was a brutal, ugly mess. In response to that now, Texas Governor Greg Abbott has vowed to steal even more seats if California has the temerity to do what Texas is doing, though, to be fair, in California's case, it would have to be with the express permission of the voters at the ballot box this November. But here's Texas Governor Abbott on Fox News this week vowing to gerrymander even harder if Newsom dares take action in response.
But I'll tell you this, if California thinks they're going to move their needle to the extreme and eliminate 5 Republican members of the United States Congress there, Texas is not going to do 5. We'll add 10 more Republican seats using the same procedure they're using in California. We have more Democrat seats that can turn into Republican seats than they have Republican seats in California that they can turn into Democrat seats.
As you can see, this can and arguably will turn into a race to the gerrymandering bottom, it seems to me. And it does have at least some Republicans who face being rewritten out of their own state's U.S. House delegation concerned. California's Republican 3rd District Congressman is Kevin Kiley is introducing what would seem to be a long shot legislation at this point to bar mid-decade redistricting by states, telling Fox News last week, quote, "It creates a lot of instability if you're just constantly shifting the lines on the map around so that, you know, representatives are losing constituents, losing communities, gaining new ones. People elect one person as their representative," he said, "and then suddenly that person is representing an entirely different area." Kiley went on to describe the situation as, quote, "just total chaos." He said it's not good for representative government, it's not good for constituents, it's not good for Democrats or Republicans. Of course, as noted, despite Kiley winning his Northern California district last year by a comfortable margin, he is one of the Republicans likely to be sidelined if California moves forward with its effort in response to what Texas is hoping to do. And there has been little effort by Republicans in Congress in recent years to do anything about partisan gerrymandering. They have blocked efforts to do so by Democrats in recent years, and House Speaker Mike Johnson has not said anything to date about what Trump and Abbott are attempting in the Lone Star State before next year's midterms. That said, Democrats have been no angels here either, despite recent attempts, at least nationally, to take action on this, and in a number of states controlled by Democrats, where, like California, they have instituted nonpartisan commissions to draw their maps. But as Fred Bauer points out in an op-ed this week in the Washington Post, it's hard to look at the Jackson Pollock districts of Illinois, for instance, and think that they are in any way representative of the state or its communities. Republicans, he notes, won 47% of the state in the state's 2024 House races, but got just 18% of the seats in the state's U.S. House delegation. The desire for reform, he notes, also tends to shift with the partisan winds. Democrats back federal legislation to address gerrymandering today, but when friendly district lines helped give them a near lock on the House for decades, it was Republicans who then led the charge in Congress to make maps fairer. But the fact that both parties have felt the sting from gerrymandering should be an opportunity to find common ground, argues Bauer, even if the word should is doing a lot of work in that sentence. There is no need, he says, for a partisan arms race when there are ways to make Congress more responsive to its voters without giving a guaranteed advantage to either party. Maybe the deadlock over redistricting could be an opening for bigger reforms, observes an optimistic Bauer. Few observers see the House as a well-functioning body. The loss of swing districts has made it increasingly sclerotic and internally polarized. And in fact, I will note here that as recently as 2010, before the Republican Party's original big Karl Rove computerized redistricting push known as Red Map, there were at least 100 or so swing districts represented in Congress. Today, that number is closer to 30 or 40 at best. At the same time, observes Bauer, the average size of congressional districts is now nearing 800,000 residents, distancing members of the supposed People's House from the people. The tensions over redistricting, he writes, could help forge a deal to resolve some of the underlying drivers of this legislative dysfunction. And he suggests there's a way to do so where, quote, everyone wins. Is there? Joining us now is Fred Bauer, who I will note up front tends to come at this issue from the right, whereas I, as you likely know, come at it from the progressive left. But if there is anything but a race to the gerrymandering bottom to be avoided on this issue, solutions will have to be found and agreed to by both the left and the right, it seems to me. So why not start here? Fred Bauer is a political writer and a longtime contributor to National Review, American Conservative, The Atlantic, the now defunct Weekly Standard, and other publications, including The Washington Post, which ran his opinion piece headlined, "There's a Way to End Texas's Redistricting War," where everyone wins. Well, we'll see about that. Mr. Bauer, thank you, sir, for joining us today on the broadcast.
Thanks for having me on, Brad. Appreciate it.
I should also note, Fred, that when it comes to elections and election integrity, while I come personally from the left, my work on behalf of assuring that every legal voter who wishes to vote gets to vote, is allowed to, their votes are counted fairly and transparently, that is decidedly, as I see it, a nonpartisan effort. I've opposed gerrymandering by the right and the left over the years. But to lay my cards on the table, I take little comfort in supporting the efforts by governors like Newsom, my own governor out here in California, to fight fire with fire. I hate supporting that effort, in fact, but I do, because I think what Texas is doing is so egregious. So I want to be upfront about my own biases here, Fred, before we get to your idea or ideas for redistricting reform in Congress, as discussed in your piece. I leave it to you, seriously. But do you wish to lay any of your own personal cards on the table concerning the immediate Texas matter and the response from California, et cetera?
Yeah, well, first of all, Brad, I will plead guilty to the charge of optimist there. I realize the piece I wrote for the Washington Post was optimistic in its phrasing. Mm-hmm. But I think that optimism is at least hope, you know, is informed by at least some sense of reality. Because I think from both the left and the right perspective, this kind of project of perpetual escalation, there's a logic to it, right? I mean, you know, California feels like it has to do what, in response to Texas, as you put it, you know, fight fire with fire. Mm-hmm. I'm sure if you go to places on the right, you can see other rationalizations. Okay, Texas needs to do what it's doing because Illinois did what it did. You know, I mean, which you've seen many people say that. Mm-hmm. And I think the issue is that both sides are, as it were, are responding rationally to the current system of incentives. To, you know, divide up the map as quickly as you can. And I think, as I mentioned in the Post piece, one of the issues that we face in our politics right now is that elections are so close. I think basically the 2020 and 2024 elections, House elections, were nail biters, right? I mean, I think if a few House seats had broken one way or the other, they would have changed control of the mm-hmm. House.
Yep.
And I think that's in the background of redistricting battle over 2026. I mean, it seems to me, again, I'm not like a super wonk on this. I'm open to correction. It seems to me that if we have a sort of a 2018 style wave election, it really doesn't matter how much you gerrymander the map because, I mean, one side or the other will win. I think it's that both parties are afraid that it will be another sort of nail-biter election decided by within, I don't know, 3 or 4 percentage points, in which case actually how you draw the map could have profound consequences for control of the House.
Yeah.
And that could have a lot of, all sorts of downstream effects on, you know, what the current administration can do. And so I think it's the closeness of our battles and also the deep divisions within our sides that have fueled some of these conflicts. And gerrymandering is very, very old. I mean, if you look back, what they were doing things like this in the early 1800s with certain districts, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think especially when you have high levels of political conflict, that's going to happen. But I think the thing is to try to think about how can adapt institutions to try to deal with those really very real conflicts that we're having right now.
Fair enough. And I feel like because I want to find the common ground before we move forward. But I do feel somewhat constitutionally obligated to note that while we're pointing to Illinois and in fact, some of their districts are just egregious. Look at the 13th district in the state there. The fact of the matter is, you know, I touched base with our friend, I don't know if you know him, redistricting expert and author David Daley. I checked in with him to get sort of his response to your suggestion, which we have yet to get to in your Washington Post piece. And he basically notes that while it's true regarding Illinois gerrymandering and to an extent Maryland, basically, folks on the right, like yourself, are sort of advancing a both sides argument here when the numbers really don't add up. That, you know, that may have been true prior to 2010 and the Karl Rove Red Map project. But now there are very few swing districts left. The right really has computerized their gerrymandering, while many states on the left have turned to independent redistricting commissions. It's not really, it's a both sides issue, but that I think does somewhat of a disservice to what's really going on here. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I mean, part of it is, I guess, tomato, tomato. I mean, how you decide to slice it. I mean, I do think that if you look at, I mean, it's true, some Democratic held states have moved towards a more so-called independent redistricting commission. I think if you look at how those commissions have drawn, I know, again, I'm not super well read on this issue, so I can't argue about specifics about them. I know some people on the right have argued that some of these commissions might not be as independent as they seem, or they might still have some sort of people still with some political sympathies involved in shaping the districts. And I think it's a real a thing that I personally struggle with and conflicted with. That on one hand, I would like to say that drawing districts is fundamentally a political question, right? And I think that to that extent, there's a case to be made that it should be up to sort of political entities to do that.
It's a political question, but it's not necessarily a partisan question.
Right.
Or shouldn't
be. Well, that's the other side of it, right? Yeah. And that, like, is there a way of channeling some of those political energies through certain kinds of, like, redistricting commissions that would give, say, some representation different party stakeholders, so there is still some, like, political accountability there, but isn't just simply reducible to that?
And I know that, in fact, Democrats have put forward some solutions in that regard in Congress. They were stopped by Republicans. But really, and I mean this, I'm not here to find differences. I'm here to see if we can find some common ground. And I think you offer an interesting idea in your post piece. In addition to banning mid-decade redistricting, like we're seeing right now in Texas and maybe soon in California in response, as California Republican Congressman Kevin Kiley, he's calling for, opportunistically or not, there is another provision, you note, that members of Congress could all get behind, and that might help this current mess. I want to let you explain the interesting idea to make sure that I don't do so incorrectly. What do you have in mind for a reform here that, as you argue, would allow everyone to win?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, the key question I'm trying to think about is here is how can we shift our current congressional districts from being engines of polarization to better be engines of representation? Mm-hmm. And I think, so maybe one thing is maybe we could ban mid-decade redistricting, so we're not always just like drawing a new map every 2 years or mm-hmm. something. Mm-hmm. But also to think about something I think there is agreement on both, I think, the left and the right for, is maybe trying to expand the size of the House of Representatives. Because we've locked the House of Representatives in one size, since 425, basically since the late 1920s. There was a brief blip when they added Hawaii and Alaska, where they added a couple seats. But basically, mm-hmm. it's been locked at the same size for a century. And as you noted in your intro, that has caused House seats now to represent almost 800,000 people, mm-hmm. which is awfully big. It's way outside most other peer, say, democracies. Mm-hmm. I mean, like in the United Kingdom, a member of parliament represents 100,000 people because mm-hmm. That House of Commons is bigger and also the population size is smaller.
As opposed to 800,000 that we're looking at for congressional districts here in the U.S. Yeah.
So it's this ironic thing that, here, the United States, the so-called, birthplace of modern, democracy, mm-hmm. and our House is far less representative than the House of Commons. The country that we declared a revolution from almost 250 years ago. Hmm. I don't think we can quite get to the size of the House of Commons, or I'm not quite sure about that. That might make the House too big, but we could at least, I propose one option is the pump that some people have talked about, which is the so-called Wyoming rule, mm-hmm. which would expand the size of the House of Representatives until each House member represents roughly the number of people that would be represented by the smallest state. So in this case, it's Wyoming. Mm-hmm. And people say that would add around 140 seats to Congress. Mm-hmm. There's not a clear, at least at this moment, when you look at it, there's not a clear sense of who would gain from that. I mean, I think based on how districts are drawn and how people run races, there might be one side that wins. But I think when we fire the starting gun, if you were to add seats, you wouldn't necessarily know who wins, which is why I think something like that could actually pass, right? Because as you mentioned at your intro, if there's a so-called reform that's clearly going to hurt one side or the other side, it's not going to pass.
Well, I got to say, and this is what drew me to your piece, Fred, I like the idea of more representation for fewer people in each district in principle. But I have questions that I'm hoping you can speak to. For a start, we're talking about adding potentially about 140 new seats to the House. What would keep those new seats? And you argue this could be done in advance of even next year's midterms. But what would keep those new seats from being similarly gerrymandered with, you know, computerized redistricting, et cetera, by each state legislature. Anything?
I think this is a real issue. Some people I've seen talk about just adding more seats to the House as a one-shot solution to fix gerrymandering, and I don't think it will do that.
Mm-hmm.
I think in certain states, it depends on how you slice it, it might make gerrymandering a little bit harder or might sort of like shift how the gerrymandering breaks. For instance, like in Connecticut right now, even though Republicans have gotten around 40% of the vote in recent elections, they've been basically locked out of the House simply because there are only five seats. And it's pretty easy to draw Connecticut, so you have five seats that there's, you know, Republicans can't win in. I think if you added a couple seats to Connecticut, that might be harder, right? And so there at least might be one seat or two seats that would go Republican. I think that is an issue, and that's one of the reasons why I floated. I mean, again, not completely endorsing, but would also float maybe Congress thinking about other provisions they could do to affect how maps are drawn. For instance, I floated one standard, which again, I'm not, you know, I'm super committed to, just an idea to think about, mm-hmm. that in 1911, Congress outlined a mandated that all districts be both contiguous and compact.
Mm-hmm.
And contiguous makes sense, so they're all attached, but also compact. So that way you can't have these weird sort of branching kind of, you know, crossword style mm-hmm. districts. They would be a little bit more condensed. And that would start to put limits on how people could draw the maps, right? For instance, if you had to keep county lines intact, it would make it harder to do so. Now, again, this is a guy who's coming from the right, but the political consultant Ryan Jarduski recently online has been sort of giving up some sample maps if you drew them under the standards of compactness. And actually, it starts to be a lot more representative, at least compared to many of our other gerrymandered districts. Like, he drew a map, say, of Texas under this compactness standard where, mm-hmm. again, you couldn't divide a county in half. You'd have to, like, keep the whole county inside of it. You could only start to divide a county mm-hmm. by a congressional district if there was no more space for it. And it starts to look kind of balanced because it would give 12 strong Democratic seats, 21 strong Republican seats, and five swing districts. Now, again, that's not a completely proportional representation, but it's a lot more proportional than some people have proposed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think most importantly, it increased the number of swing seats, because I think that's a really important component of that.
It is. But that said, I know that Democrats have been calling for that. They've been roundly rejected by the entirety of the Republican Party, including folks like Kevin Kiley, who, you know, now sees his seat potentially endangered. And so now all of a sudden they're in favor of redistricting reform, but that's okay. I'll take it whenever it comes, however it comes. But on the idea of simply adding 140 seats, again, I like the idea in general. More representation, I think, is better. But do we know how that would break? Let's say that it was gerrymandered, because currently there's nothing to keep them from partisan gerrymandering anymore. The Supreme Court has just ducked out of this issue, said it's not the job of the federal courts, that partisans are allowed to partisan gerrymander. So if we added 140 seats, given the control of each of the states and so forth around the country right now, do we end up just having gerrymandering, the same gerrymandering, but more of it, but now in all 50 states as they add these new seats and rewrite the old ones in the bargain, Fred?
Well, I mean, that's, I think, why I think Congress, if it were to pass something like that, would have to think in a hard way and see what compromises it could draw in terms of if it were to put any limits on it, such as, you know, again, putting compactness standard. Maybe also, I know people have different opinions about this, but one idea also brought up is maybe also withdrawing the 1967 law the Congress passed, which requires single member districts. Because right now, under congressional law, all congressional districts have to be single member, which opens up all sorts of possibilities for gerrymandering. If you were to shift, as some people have argued, to more proportional system of representation, or at least allow states to create proportional systems
right.
of representation, that could also limit the ability for gerrymandering, right? Because you could say, here's a district that has five seats, and those five seats will be assigned proportionally based on, I mean, you can create different proportional systems, but based on the electoral outcomes, in which case it doesn't really matter how much you draw the map because everyone's just going to vote. They're casting their vote for different parties mm-hmm. or for different candidates within it, and it could be broken down that way. And I don't know personally if I would necessarily, I mean, because as you mentioned, I'm more on the conservative side of things. I would not know if I would necessarily say Congress should like mandate proportional representation, but could at least open the door to that and allow some states to experiment with that and see how it goes. I think there's a credible argument for that.
So when we just to underscore, because it's an idea that is, I think, a good idea, but it's relatively foreign to a lot of folks. When we talk about proportional representation, right now we have, you know, one congressman or woman for each district. This would expand the number of representatives in each district to whatever number, three or four or so forth, depending on how people vote. If they vote a little bit more Republican, there'd be a few more Republican representatives. Is that generally what you think about when you talk about proportional redistricting?
Yes, that's generally what people are thinking about that, yeah.
And in a case like that, how would each district still have just one vote in Congress?
No, I think each district would put its, you know, how many ever Congress people were associated with that. Mm-hmm. So if a district was drawn so it had five representatives and say Republicans win three and Democrats win two, mm-hmm. each of those members would be House members. Each of them would vote. The district would simply just be used as an electoral method for like creating the pool mm-hmm. that those individual House members are selected from.
Well, in that case, therefore, doesn't this have to be a, pardon the phrase here, a 50-state strategy? Wouldn't all states sort of have to do this at once to keep certain states who do become, proportionally representative from having more votes, essentially, in Congress than they should?
Well, I think you could structure so that it wouldn't necessarily directly fit other states. Because say, I mean, let's just go along with the hypothetical here. I mean, mm-hmm. say under current allocations, say, you know, Texas were to adopt proportional representation, mm-hmm. but Florida didn't, right? You know, just pick two states at random. Texas would still have the same number of seats that it has in the House. It would say have, I mean, what does that come out to right now? Is it 37 or so House seats, mm-hmm. or 38 House seats? It would still have the same number, just how those seats would be parceled out because, you know, say Texas adopted proportional representation. Let's just say they went all proportional. They say, okay, all of Texas is one big, as it were, district mm-hmm. for the purposes of proportional representation. We've got 30 seats up for grabs. And so
I see.
I mean, so Republicans will say have like picked up, say, 25 of those, and Democrats would pick up the other 13, and that's how they would go, whereas Florida would still be just individual districts, and each district would win based on that election.
I see. So what we would have to do, essentially, even if, I mean, it seems to me that, and we're back to that word optimistic again, but it seems to me the optimistic idea that we could simply add 140 new seats before the next year's elections, and that there would be so many seats in all, essentially all of the states, that neither of the major parties would know how things would break out. They'd all therefore be in favor of this. That seems to be somewhat optimistic, presuming we could even, you know, get anything through the House or the Senate or signed by this particular president. But it seems like it would have to be coupled with some of these other reforms at the same time. Otherwise, it seems like we're just going to have more, more districts, more gerrymandering in all 50 states.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest. I mean, I think there are all sorts of good reasons for expanding the House that are sort of separate from the redistricting. So I think if we even just get that, that would be a good thing. Mm-hmm. But I do agree, if you're really concerned about the gerrymandering issue, I think probably other reforms would have to be very seriously considered, because I don't think, as much as I'm in favor of adding seats to the House, and I think it would be good for a lot of political actors too, by the way, because, I mean, if I were an incumbent Democrat right now, I'd want the House to be expanded. So that, you know, some new challenger might be thinking, oh, I'll run that open seat that's just been created rather than challenging me as an incumbent. Mm. But I mean, I think it could be in their personal self-interest for that. But I think if you're really concerned about the gerrymandering, you'd really want to think seriously about some other reforms. In addition to that, I mean, I think that expanding the House would be like a sweetener, would have some other good benefits, but would not be like a panacea for all those gerrymandering problems.
And any new plan, just to be clear, would have to be that Congress itself decides how to apportion, right? This is not something that is specifically described by the Constitution, that, in other words, an act of Congress can change the way these districts happen across the country?
Oh, yes. There are a few limits, I mean, but basically it's totally up to Congress. I mean, Congress has to base its apportionment on the census. It can't just like do it on its own. It can't just say, oh, California gets 300 seats.
Right.
I mean, it has to like base it on the census. But no, Congress has a lot of authority, and it used to exercise more authority in the 20th century, sort of changed it to make the redistricting a little more automatic. But it does have a lot of authority for how apportionment works.
And any new plan, therefore, passed by Congress presumably would have to get over a Senate filibuster to pass. It had to be passed in both chambers and then signed by the president. Is there any chance that a President Trump, Fred Bauer, would sign such a bill if he did not see it as offering an advantage to his party over what is now in place?
Well, that's the issue. I mean, I think expanding the House and that sort of tactic is it's like a high stakes kind of gamble, because I think if you look at the current war of attrition about gerrymandering, it probably Republicans can probably eke out an edge from that, because I think even if some Democratic states gerrymander a little bit more, Republicans can gerrymander enough in their states that they can probably net a few additional seats. Expanding the House would really sort of raise the stakes. There's a chance Republicans could pick up a lot more seats than just like two or three, right? Mm-hmm. But there's a chance also they could lose seats, depending on how those seats are drawn, too.
Well,
it's a big gamble.
It is a gamble. And on the other side of that equation, if it was something that Donald Trump would be in favor of, presumably only because he's come to understand that it's going to benefit Republicans. In that case, it seems hard to believe that Democrats would actually go for such a scheme, at least in such short order, unless, of course, it's paired, as we discussed, you know, with something else, with districts that must be contiguous or some other way to level that playing field.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I will just say, just as one plug, I think from the Trump perspective, if the House were to be expanded, that would be a big legacy item for Trump, right? You know, it's like, you know, make the House greater again, right? So, and he's very concerned about his legacy. So maybe that's something that could be used to appeal to him as this, if he were to think about this, you know, because again, he's not constrained by the ways that many other conventional politicians are.
Well, that's a nice way to put it, Fred. I will leave it to you. I suspect he doesn't listen too closely to me, so I will leave it to you to work on him on that, Fred. Before I let you go, what sort of response have you received from your Everyone Wins piece arguing for adding another 140 members at Washington Post this week?
Well, from one person I know who follows politics very closely, I'm in D.C., he messaged me to say, I totally agree with you, but I'm basically under no illusions this would ever actually be, you know, passed into law right now. But this is what we should be doing. So I think that's, unfortunately, I think you're not alone in thinking that I'm an optimist in laying out this idea.
Well, if nothing else, I think what we should be doing is having these discussions, to be frank, because this problem seems to me, is only ever going to be fixed when all sides sort of agree with doing so. Maybe all sides will have to be hurt as much until they're willing to do so. But when they're finally willing to do so, it would be nice to have some ideas in place on the morning after, as it were. And so, Fred, I really appreciate your putting forward these ideas in your piece. I even more so appreciate your willingness to come on and talk to us about them. I'd love to have you back. We can bicker even more about partisan ideas in the future. Okay. But here we've got some grounds that I think we're both trying to find some common ground on, and I think that's very much needed. Thank you, Fred. You can find Fred's work. You can follow him on the Blue Skies and the Twitters at Fred Bauer Blog. And you can sign up for his Substack newsletter at roundingup.substack.com. Really appreciate you joining us today on the broadcast, sir.
Thanks for having me, and I appreciate that chance to talk across some partisan differences.
As do I. Thank you, sir. Well, now that said,
yeah,
it might not be a matter of all the sides coming together, because if we keep going down farther and farther to the bottom, it might be, you know, as we saw under the Biden administration, Democrats were saying, well, we're going to change the rules here hopefully for the better with expanding the Voting Rights Act and so forth. Now, they were stopped by a couple of supposed Democrats, Joe Manchin and what's her name?
Kyrsten Sinema.
There you go. I've been trying to forget them both. They were stopped at the time by them. But it may be, you know, Democrats having to come in and say, look, whether you like it or not, all the states are going to have to be drawn fairly. We'll see. Or it's going to take the compromise that Fred and I were talking about there.
Yeah, we'll see if Republicans, after having taken this route and gone full on war, are going to be willing to compromise and come together in some kind of pathway forward. Jamel Bowie, New York Times columnist, had brought up a similar concept. He said, look, I don't think it's going to be possible to do a bipartisan reform that moves us all forward. He said, might be like after the Civil War with Reconstruction and after the Civil Rights Act, when Democrats had to basically say, no, this is how it's going to be, and you will follow this new law, way of doing things.
And that may be the way it happens. I guess it depends who finds that. Yeah, I guess it comes down to the voters again.
Yeah.
What are the voters going to say if there's a wipeout next year, if Republicans are wiped out, lose their majority in the House and perhaps in the Senate, where it'll be even more extraordinary if that happens? Well, maybe they'll be whistling a different tune.
Maybe
we'll see.
We'll see. It depends on if voters are able to vote, if their votes are actually counted as cast, and those election results continue if they are allowed to stand. So, we've definitely seen partisan warfare around elections and voting escalate dramatically.
Are you suggesting that Republicans and Donald Trump might not accept the election results as they come in?
Yeah, I don't know where I get that idea, but yeah, that's my basic thought here. We'll see what happens. We'll see how much voters mobilize themselves to effect change.
It's always up to the voters to fight like hell. All right. Thank you very much. Thanks again to Fred Bauer for joining us today. It's greatly appreciated. Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen. And as always, thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is always an honor. We do hope we make it worth your while each and every day. We work hard toward that end, and we appreciate your support, and we appreciate even more so those of you who stop by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves and continue to do what we try to do every day. A one-time donation of any amount you can afford is greatly appreciated, as is a monthly subscription of any amount you can afford. That's even greatlier appreciated. Bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com, and you can find me on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, at the Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
There's got to be a morning after. If we can hold on through the night, we have a chance to find the sunshine. Let's keep on looking for the light.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.